Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced by WEKU and Dynamics Productions.
What does it mean? To be American.
I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us for this latest in our series, Democracy Optimist, with University of Kentucky Election and Voting Law Research Professor Joshua Douglas. Later in the hour, we have Rachel Bellin and Louisa Sanchez from the Kentucky Student Voice Team. The group is now raising serious questions about whether the Commonwealth schools are once again falling short of what's required by the state constitution. First, the argument for lowering the voting age. Here's Josh Douglas.
Welcome to Democracy Optimist, where we discuss the current state of American democracy, recognizing the risks it faces, while still offering a glimmer of hope along the way. At the founding of our country, only white male property owners who were at least 21 years old could vote. Over time, we removed property requirements, expanded suffrage to racial minorities and women, and, through the 26th Amendment, lowered the voting age to 18. Why 18? That is, in some ways, a historical accident. It was initially 21 because that was the rule under British common law. And 21 was the voting age back then because, in medieval times, 21 was believed to be the age when a young man was strong enough to wear a full suit of heavy armor and was therefore eligible for knighthood. So the U.S. adopted 21 at the founding because that's what it always was. Then, during World War II, Congress lowered the draft age from 21 to 18 because we needed more soldiers. And that's when the push to lower the voting age to 18 began. It all culminated decades later in the Vietnam War, when many young people were sent to fight a war that they opposed. The rallying cry, "Old enough to fight, old enough to vote," was persuasive. On July 5, 1971, President Richard Nixon signed the 26th Amendment into law. Some states, however, had lowered the voting age even before the 26th Amendment. Kentucky, for example, set the voting age to 18 in 1955, 16 years before the 26th Amendment. And today, some places in the U.S. have lowered the voting age to 16 for local or school board elections. The U.S. Constitution permits this. It says that no state can deny the right to vote to those aged 18 or older, but it says nothing about whether a state or locality can go lower than 18. Over the past decade, the Vote 16 movement has gained momentum. A dozen cities across four states now allow 16 and 17-year-olds to vote in local or school board elections, including Newark, New Jersey, the largest city to do so. For many advocates, expanding the franchise to younger voters is a response to concerns about youth engagement, civic readiness, and the long-term health of our democracy. Here to discuss lowering the voting age to 16 is Lawan Allen, the executive director of Vote 16 USA, a nonprofit dedicated to the movement. Full disclosure, I serve on its national advisory board. Lawan, welcome to Democracy Optimist.
Thank you so much for having me, Josh. It is a pleasure to be able to connect with you and talk about the movement to lower the voting age to 16.
Yeah, so tell us more about the organization Vote 16 USA and how you became involved in this effort.
Yeah, thank you for the question. So Vote 16 USA is a national nonprofit organization that supports youth-led campaigns to extend voting rights to 16 and 17-year-olds in local, state, and federal elections. This organization was started in 2015 as a result of a vote that happened 2 years prior in Tacoma Park, Maryland, which became the first state to, the first city to lower the voting age to 16 for all municipal elections in 2013. And so, you know, we support our young people in a variety of ways. We provide them with opportunities to testify and to show exactly why they believe that they should have a real voting voice in our democracy. And so since our inception 10 years ago, cities up and down this country and every corner of the country and certainly states have begun to have the conversation about what it means to incorporate 16 and 17-year-olds more meaningfully into our democracy.
So let's talk about some of the best arguments or the benefits that you promote. And I like how you talked about how it's the youth in these cities that are really engaged in the effort. And I want to discuss that in a few minutes. But first, just what are the benefits? Why lower the voting age to 16 for local or school board elections?
Yeah, great question. There are so many benefits to lowering the voting age to 16. Young people are at the forefront of every movement in the country. When we think about climate justice reform, when we think about common sense gun legislation, when we think about high quality education policy, it is young people pleading with us as the adults of the country to get this right. Young people will inherit the country that we leave them, and the decisions that we make today disproportionately impact young people. And so this idea that young people are not engaged, that young people don't care, the only thing that they care about is social media, is just completely inaccurate. And the young people within the Vote 16 movement is proof of that. They care about their communities. They care about the country that we will leave them. Another compelling argument is that 16 is a really critical age. It is around the time where young people have an inclination to risk take. And we believe that lowering the voting age, allowing young people to participate in democratic processes, provides them with a positive avenue to explore that inclination. This is something positive that you can put your energy into that will have a great social benefit. Not to mention that in the places where we've seen the voting age be lowered, voter turnout is not only increased amongst those 16 and 17, meaning they're voting at higher rates than those that are 18 and older. But over time, what we also see is that those 18 and older are also voting at higher rates. So what that tells us is that 16 and 17 year olds also motivate the adults in their life to get out the vote, which makes our democracy more just, representative, and resilient.
So as I noted in the introduction, about a dozen cities have lowered the voting age to 16, mostly for local elections, a couple of them just for school board elections. What has the experience been like in those places, and what has surprised local officials and voters themselves the most?
I think what has surprised folks in these communities the most is that young people are hyper aware of what's happening around them. They have a lot to contribute when it comes to some of the most pressing issues in the communities that our young people live in. They continue to provide and to want to contribute really innovative solutions. Now, Vote 16 is not the panacea to solving the issues that we deal with in our democracy, but it's certainly a meaningful step towards making our democracy more representative. So I think that has been the feedback that I've heard consistently, is that young people do care. Young people are concerned about the country that they will inherit. And so that is a message across the cities that we've seen this happen, where that type of thinking and message resonates with the residents there.
All right. So you've been pretty positive about what this movement can be and why it benefits democracy to lower the voting age. But a lot of people are skeptical. And you're going to hear, I'm sure you have heard, a lot of opposition to the idea. So let's tackle some of those objections. First, there's kind of the psychological viewpoint of 16-year-olds' brains aren't developed. That frontal cortex we hear about, that means that people are just not developed enough to act as adults at age 16. What say you?
Yeah, that's a great argument, one we hear consistently as well. And what I will say is that we work with the Vote 16 Research Network, and there's tons and tons of data on this exact question. And I will tell you, the science supports lowering the voting age. Voting requires what they call code cognition. Cognitive ability is the ability to make an informed decision when giving the right tools, time, and resources. And we know that that's what voting requires. We also know that code cognitive ability does not change much after the age of 16. And so someone's code cognitive ability at 16 is relatively the same as someone who's 30, 40, 70, and beyond. And so if we're talking about the science behind and the brain development behind lowering the voting age, the science supports it.
So let's just dive into this a tiny bit deeper. So you said that cold cognition is the kind of things that voting is about, that it requires this cold cognition. How does that contrast with hot cognition?
Well, hot cognition is essentially the same scenario, but opposite conditions, right? When young people are not given the time, when they're forced to make a really quick and rapid decision, when they're put under pressure to make a decision.
Peer pressure in particular.
Peer pressure in particular, that's a great example. The data does show that 16 and 17-year-olds still have some work to do when it comes to hot cognitive ability, but that's not what voting requires, right? Voting requires cold cognitive ability, and when we lower the voting age, young people begin to talk amongst themselves about the candidates and the issues that most impact them, and that's what we mean by tools, time, and resources in order to make an educated decision about which candidate or which policy issue they'll vote for based on those tools.
Well, let's say I'm with you on the science, or at least I'll trust the scientists that 16-year-old brains are developed for cold cognition and therefore voting. But 16-year-olds haven't had the same kind of life experiences. Most of them haven't and don't have to yet pay taxes. So doesn't voting require some sort of perspective that 16-year-olds simply don't have yet?
We trust 16 and 17-year-olds to do adult things in our society today. We trust them to work. We trust them to drive. And we know what it means to be on the road. We trust them. And some of them, those who work absolutely pay taxes. I come from Boston, and we learned a lot about taxation without representation. There are millions of 16 and 17-year-olds in our country who work and pay taxes. 16 and 17-year-olds can donate blood. 16 and 17-year-olds can sit in the emergency aisle on an airplane and be trusted to help others on a plane in case of an emergency. So we trust 16 and 17-year-olds to do adult things, and yet we completely disregard them when it comes to the political process. We completely disregard that they have anything meaningful to contribute to this conversation. And to me, that is a gross injustice, and speaks to the idea that, we have really low voter turnout, we have really low engagement among young people within our democratic processes. And this could be a really meaningful step to try to remedy that and get young people excited about democratic participation.
But most 16 and 17-year-olds are still living at home. They're still going to school. So isn't this just going to give their parents essentially an extra vote, or these people will be influenced by their teachers?
Once again, fantastic question. And I think the first part of that question in terms of living at home and having that stability is actually an argument in our favor, right? When you're 18, you are in a really interesting time in your life, right? You've most likely graduated or about to graduate from high school. You're most likely going to go off to a higher education institution, and most likely not worrying about when your next election is, or how you're going to register to vote, or how you're going to request an absentee ballot or mail ballot. And so, at 16, you do have this stability that I think allows you to be more ingrained in what's happening around you. And in terms of your second part of the question, living with your parents and being influenced by your parents, I think that used to be true, where essentially families would vote as a household. We've seen that, throughout the 60s and 70s and 80s, where it was a household that voted the same way. And I think we're seeing that. We're not seeing those same trends today. There was a recent study conducted out of Scotland, but what they found was that young people are no longer voting like their parents because their parents told them to. What they found in this particular study was that 40% of the group that they did this study on did not vote like their parents, which means 60% did. And so when they asked for feedback from the young people about why they voted this particular way, none of them brought up the fact that their parents, they knew that their parents were also voting that way. Most of the feedback that they received was that they voted for this particular candidate because they believed that candidate had their best interests in mind. And so we are no longer voting as a family. I think young people have the ability to vote the way that they feel is in their best interest.
We're speaking with Lawan Allen, who's the executive director of Vote 16 USA. Lawan, one more question on potential objections before I let you off the hot seat in just responding to all the reasons why this doesn't make sense. All of the cities that have lowered the voting age so far in the United States are in blue areas of the country. You've got Maryland, you've got Vermont, you've got California, New Jersey. So this just sounds kind of like a liberal push to increase the voter rolls of people who tend to skew more Democratic, as young people do. What's your response to that objection?
You know, it's a fantastic point. And let me just say this, you know, lowering the voting age is the next big thing in American democracy. Lowering the voting age is not a political power grab for Democrats. What we've seen in the last presidential election, as an example, was a dramatic shift of those 18 to 29 voting for the Republican candidate and now president. What we've seen is that, again, young people have the ability to pick a candidate based on their own political and moral values. But what the trend is telling us is that young people are actually becoming more conservative. I don't have the exact numbers on me, but I do know that amongst 18 to 29 year olds in Biden's former President Biden's first election, there was a huge, I think it was like 20, plus 25 for Biden at that time. And for Kamala, it was plus 4. And so we saw a real shift. And I think that speaks to, again, young people's ability to choose a candidate that they believe, you know, works in their best interests.
So, and importantly, Vote 16 USA is a nonpartisan organization.
Absolutely.
So you don't really care which areas of the country engage in this effort.
Absolutely not.
When I talk about the voting age, I've found that this is an issue that actually can change people's minds. Unlike so many other things when people are really entrenched in their viewpoints, I've found that this is something that, you know, the arguments about lowering the voting age actually can shift people's perceptions. Can you share a story of someone who maybe was adamantly opposed that now is in favor of the idea?
Absolutely. And the person that comes to mind immediately is Governor Phil Murphy out of New Jersey. Governor Phil Murphy was not in favor of lowering the voting age when he first heard of the idea. Based on testimony given by young people and now the leaders of our Vote 16 New Jersey chapter, not only did Governor Murphy change his opinion on this issue, but he's become the most vocal elected official on a statewide level to support it. Governor Phil Murphy has mentioned lowering the voting age in his last two State of the State addresses. Governor Phil Murphy has most recently allocated $1 million in his budget to support cities within New Jersey with implementation and voter education. And so we had someone who was not in support of it, you know, and based on testimony given by young people, which we believe is the best way to shift political and public opinion on the issue is when they hear from young people. We saw Governor Phil Murphy dramatically change his stance and invest in the movement in a way that was meaningful and got Newark, New Jersey to do this with his support. And so we're going to continue to see places in New Jersey lower the voting age as well.
And Newark did so for school board elections. And there's got to be some implementation challenges or hurdles. You mentioned the $1 million to help with implementation. What does this take, you know, with voter registration, with voter education, even the ballot itself? What kind of implementation things do we need to worry about?
We are building out our own internal supports with helping cities and states with implementation through support with the Vote 16 Research Network. But some things that cities and states should think about when considering lowering the voting age is cost, right? And so what we've done and what we're continuing to do is do cost analyses to better understand you know, what the cost of lowering the voting age is based on population size, based on, you know, location, whether you're in a rural or suburban area or city, whether the state, the county, or the city oversees the election. But certainly cost, and, you know, cost could be anything from updating voting machines. The worst thing for this movement would be for a 16 and 17 year old to mistakenly have voted in a federal election. That's something that we want to completely avoid and would be detrimental to the movement. And so we want to be mindful that we're making sure that our voting machines are up to date and are able to accommodate for 16 and 17 year olds voting. And in some places, separate ballots are printed. And so there's an additional cost with printing separate ballots. So those are the types of costs that cities and states should be thinking about when lowering the voting age.
What do you think the movement in American democracy will look like in 5 years, 10 years, 20 years?
I'll start from a wider view at first and then sort of hone in. You know, Vote 16 is a part of a global movement. We're not just here in the United States, right? I have counterparts in places like Scotland and New Zealand, in the UK. And, you know, we have over 20 countries that have already lowered the voting age to 16. And so what I think we're going to continue to see is countries across the globe lower the voting age. The UK back in 2025 just had announced that they will be lowering the voting age to 16 before their upcoming general election. In the United States, I think we're going to continue to see cities and states take the lead on expanding voting rights to 16 and 17 year olds. We're active in over 25 states. I think we will continue to see elected officials be open-minded to this idea. And then ultimately, you know, based on our ability to cultivate relationships with elected officials, particularly at the federal level, I do see that in 10, 15, 20 years, there being an appetite for lowering the voting age in federal elections. You know, we had an amendment introduced by Rep. Ayanna Pressley and Representative Grace Ming, both out of Massachusetts and New York, respectively. And we got 126 members of Congress to support that amendment to lower the voting age to 16, including a Republican from Texas. And so I think our movement is strong, our movement is growing, and it will continue to grow.
Lawan Allen is the executive director of Vote 16 USA, which you can find at vote16usa.org. Lawan, thank you so much for joining us on Democracy Optimist.
So, Josh, we're both dads, and so I think this was really interesting from that perspective. Lawan made the point that we trust 16-year-olds to do all kinds of things, work, drive cars, so why not trust them to vote? What was your impression of that point?
Well, of course, I'm actually part of that Vote 16 research network because I've written a lot about this issue and about the voting age, so maybe I'm biased because I have sort of encountered these arguments. But I thought he put it really nicely. And actually, I learned a little bit more. Like, I didn't realize 16 and 17 year olds can sit in the exit row on airplanes. That was new to me. And so I think he demonstrated that we do kind of treat 16 year olds as almost adult like in many aspects of our society. But, you know, the most persuasive point to me is that if we lowered the voting age for local elections and get young people in the habit of voting, then they're more likely to become habitual voters later in life. And I think that's a really important part of this conversation.
What did he have to say, Lawan Allen, that is, have to say to counter the objections to setting the voting age at 16 that impressed you?
Yeah, I mean, there's so many objections that the movement hears, but I think perhaps the most persuasive, or at least the one that stuck out to me, was the fact that this is not just a liberal push to try to get more liberal voters, because, as he said, in the 2024 election, young people swung towards the Republican candidate in numbers that we hadn't seen 4 years prior. So I think that's a good example that he doesn't care who these people are voting for. It's about the strength of our democracy. And to me, democracy is stronger when more people are participating.
You're listening to Eastern Standard. I'm Tom Martin with Josh Douglas, host of our series, Democracy Optimist. The future would like to have a word.
Young people are often described as the future of our democracy. But even before they can cast a ballot, they're already living with the consequences of political decisions, especially decisions about education. Courts and scholars alike have long recognized that a healthy democracy depends on well-educated citizens. Yet the students who walk our hallways and sit in our classrooms every day often have the least to say about how those schools are run. That silence isn't for a lack of trying. In 1989, the Kentucky Supreme Court issued its landmark decision in Rose versus Council for Better Education, holding that the state legislature had failed its constitutional duty under Section 183 of the Kentucky Constitution to provide, quote, an efficient system of common schools. The court declared the state's entire system of public education constitutionally deficient. More than 35 years later, a new generation of students is asking whether Kentucky has truly lived up to that promise. The Kentucky Student Voice Team, a statewide youth-led organization dedicated to empowering young people in civic life, is now raising serious questions about whether the Commonwealth's schools once again fall short of the constitutional standard. Here to discuss the Kentucky Student Voice Team is its managing director, as well as one of the students involved in the effort. Rachel Bellin is the managing partner of the Kentucky Student Voice Team, who has been there from the start. And with her is one of those current students, Luisa Sanchez, who is a senior at Boyle County High School. Rachel and Luisa, welcome to Democracy Optimist.
Thanks so much, Josh. So great to be here.
Great to have both of you. Rachel, let's start with you. Tell us about the origins of the Kentucky Student Voice Team. How did it come about?
Yeah, so the Kentucky Student Voice Team began way back in 2012, when Luisa was probably about 3 years old, as a pretty simple but powerful idea that young people who spend 35 plus hours a week in classrooms deserve a real say in shaping the policies and practices that affect their education. At the time, a group of high school students began having conversations with me when I was working for the Pritchard Committee, and said essentially, if the goal is education improvement, why aren't students part of these conversations? And so what began as a small discussion in a Lexington coffee shop extended to more frequent and larger conversations as students brought their friends, and we started to conduct outreach to other students in other parts of the state. And soon we were absorbed as a pilot program of the Pritchard Committee, and that's when we began to experiment. And specifically, that was when students began to both contribute to work that the Pritchard Committee was doing, but also lead some significant education research and advocacy initiatives on their own. And this is when things started getting really, really interesting. Fast forward in 2021, the Student Voice Team took me with it as we spun off from the committee and became an independent nonprofit. And we made the move so students could be better positioned to drive not only the programming, but also the entirety of the organization, something they continue to do now over 5 years later. And that includes everything from development and budgeting to board governance, communications, and everything in between. And so today we call ourselves a youth-led, intergenerationally sustained organization. And at any given time, we comprise about 100 self-selected students supported by a few adults like me, engaging thousands of young people every year through research, storytelling, policy advocacy, and more recently, litigation. And so the Kentucky Student Voice Team's simple mission is to co-create more just, democratic Kentucky schools.
So, Luisa, you're one of those students, and my understanding is that you lead the litigation committee among the students. Tell us a little bit about your involvement, why you became involved in the Student Voice Team, and a little bit about your role in overseeing some of this litigation effort.
I can start with sort of why I joined the Kentucky Student Voice Team. I joined during my freshman year of high school, and that was a very hectic period of my life as I was adjusting to new learning environments and also just like coming to understand the importance of education and how it really is the foundation to having in our country a successful future and why it matters. And so I really wanted to understand why it was that school communities across Kentucky were so vastly different from each other. I wanted to learn more about the disparities that exist in Kentucky classrooms and why that is and what we can do to change it. I know even in my own school, just throughout high school, there are very limited civic opportunities, given that we are in a rural area and a lot of times teachers focus more on standardized testing as opposed to project-based work and getting out in the community and volunteering and things of that nature. And so I really wanted to be involved in work that allowed me to create real life impact. And that is the Kentucky Student Voice Team. And I remember sophomore year, just seeing the English language learners in my school not have a formal classroom. They had to be in the library or sometimes even in the counseling office because it was a small group and there are limited English language teachers. And so seeing all of that truly broke my heart. And I think everyone should deserve to have an equitable education that works for them. And so in order to combat these problems, I really wanted to be involved in an effort like the Kentucky Student Voice Team. And so, yeah, I think KSBT really is a place where adults don't just listen to students, but it's actually us leading the impact. And we are treated as partners in generating and co-designing improvements within schools. And so I started in the New EDU, which is the independent news reporting platform of the Kentucky Student Voice Team. And that was amazing, getting to tell the stories of awesome Kentucky students. And then I also lean into the research and policy side of KSBT. And when it comes to litigation, I am a plaintiff in the lawsuit. And then also prior to that, I was a facilitator of roundtables when we did public forums to engage community members and assess whether or not Kentucky was living up to its constitutional promise of an adequate and equitable education for students. And so I really got to be involved in our Rose work since the start, and now it's growing more than ever before. And so now I can engage with students that are also very passionate about the lawsuit, and it's been incredible.
So, Louisa, let's talk a little bit more about that lawsuit. You said you're a plaintiff. The Kentucky Student Voice Team, and you being one of the plaintiffs, is challenging the state's education system again, saying that the state is not living up to the promise of that Rose decision from 1989. What's the basic argument that you're making in this lawsuit?
When the court declared that Kentucky's education system was unconstitutional, it set forth seven Rose capacities. And so when we look at the research that we've done with the state of civics in Kentucky classrooms, which is published, we are hearing from high school students that they are not getting the opportunities to be as civically engaged as they want to. A lot of even Kentucky people don't know all three branches of government. So we are seeing a clear deficit in civics education. Also, Kentucky is one of very few states who require that students take a civics exam, but it does not require that its students take the course. And so with that, there is a gap of knowledge that students have to overcome by themselves because the system is not designed to give them the resources that they need. But that's just one part. And we can also see when it comes to mental health resources, a lot of times counselors in Kentucky classrooms have to help hundreds of students. And with the teacher shortage in staffing, a lot of times students cannot get the academic or mental health supports that they need because of counselors being overworked. And so we also made that clear in our lawsuit. And there's a lot of parts of the Seven Rose capacities that we can see that are not being fulfilled. And so that is our primary argument, is that these seven capacities, all seven of them, need to be better designed to help students. And we can see deficits in all of them.
And some of those include things like strong oral and written communication skills, knowledge of the economic, social, and political system, understanding government processes, etc. Rachel, why do you think Kentucky's education system has fallen behind, given the promise of the Rose case from 1989?
Yeah, so that's a great question. I'm so glad you and Louisa both hit on what those seven capacities are. And I would just underscore the bigger picture is that Rose laid out this much more holistic definition of what it means to have an adequate education. And we did see major gains in student achievement after Rose, especially with the Education Reform Act of 1990, which really moved the Commonwealth forward. I mean, we saw gains in student achievement, we saw gains in funding equity, teacher professionalism, and civic learning. And for a time, Kentucky really was the national model for how communities could pull together and mobilize to make significant gains in education improvement. It is something that every Kentuckian should be so proud of, to have that history be part of our Commonwealth. But, you know, the compliance wasn't sustained. That's what we're arguing. So over the decades since those initial gains, the state underfunded schools, let the teacher pipeline atrophy, narrowed curriculum, and allowed disparities to widen again. So funding plays a role in all of this, but it is definitely not the only thing at all. We're arguing that we have given up on the Rose vision of a more holistic education that prepares students to really be not only successful in our economy, but also as citizens in our country, in our community, in our Commonwealth.
We're speaking with Rachel Bellin and Louisa Sanchez of the Kentucky Student Voice team that has filed a lawsuit against the state of Kentucky for not fulfilling the promises of the Rose decision from 1989, the first state Supreme Court decision that declared a state system of education unconstitutional, and there are some other states that have followed suit. Rachel, can you help us connect these issues with democracy? I mean, this is a show about the democratic process, about voting. I'm a professor of election law and voting rights. Why should we understand this issue of adequate education and educational opportunities to the issues of democracy?
Yes, I'm so glad you asked me that, for a lot of reasons. But one of those reasons is I am a one-time high school classroom social studies teacher myself, and I really do see this work as a form of guerrilla social studies, if you will, because Rose was fundamentally a democracy case. It wasn't just about reading and math. It was about ensuring every child has the knowledge, skills, and experiences needed to participate in and contribute to civic life. So the idea is that strong public schools create informed voters, engaged community members, and resilient democratic institutions. So when education deteriorates, when civic learning disappears, when students don't understand how the government works, and by the way, three of the seven Rose capacities get at this concept very specifically, but when students lack opportunities to contribute, it weakens the entire democratic fabric of a state. And, you know, the work of the Student Voice Team, in essence, is just one beautiful example of how young people who are even too young to have a vote can still participate in democratic and civic life. And we sell young people short when we don't support them in engaging in our communities in profound ways like this. And I don't think it's a stretch at all to say that at its core, Rose is about democracy's long-term survival in Kentucky.
And Rachel, what's the state's reaction been to the lawsuit? I mean, doesn't it seem kind of obvious that we should improve the state's educational system?
The Student Voice Team itself, we have been doing, and Louisa's helped lead this work, and she alluded to it, we've been doing a lot of public engagement work related to the case. This is going to take years to work its way through the courts. We know that. And the defendants of this, representing the state, we heard from their attorneys in May. Students packed the courtroom in Franklin County to hear the arguments about whether or not we have standing in this case and to file the suit. And we're still waiting on Judge Shepard's decision there. But overall, we are hearing constantly from people everywhere who are supporting this work and the opportunity to reengage in an examination about the legacy of Rose. And the question before us all is, is the rose wilting? And if so, what can we all do as citizens in our communities to uphold this vision of a healthy and adequate public education that prepares our students to contribute and be an essential part of our democracy?
Louisa, how have adults responded to your advocacy and your efforts to advocate for students? Have you seen roadblocks? And given your response to that question, I'm curious what advice you might have for young people who want to become engaged.
A lot of my teachers have been extremely supportive of my work with the Kentucky Student Voice Team. A lot of them were informed about what the KSBT was even before I joined. I remembered when I was doing media impressions for Rose, actually, one of my English teachers just sent me this super sweet email about keeping on fighting, and I quote, the good fight. And so it brought me to tears. And I can say that for the most part, a lot of adults have been very supportive. However, sometimes it is a little... I'm a little hesitant sometimes, because I can say that my district, when SB 150 became a law, my district responded by banning over 100 books in libraries across our schools. And so just seeing that is obviously devastating. And so knowing that I'm working against that, I'm definitely wary of adults who may not be as supportive. But I really don't think it matters. That's my biggest piece of advice. It's like, if you know that you're doing impactful work that serves your community, you should not pay attention to the negative feedback that you're getting, but rather you should actually take in constructive criticism, but continue to do the work that you're doing. Because when you're trying to change systems, you also have to challenge assumptions about being a young person in this work. And so let your impacts speak for itself. And you don't always have to, again, address the haters per se. You can just continue to do the work that you're doing. And then obviously KSBT is an extremely positive community. And so you know that you have people by your side who are fighting with you. And so you're never alone in this.
I love that response because it, I think, connects in a way that maybe you didn't intend, but it connects to the history of advocacy in this country, of youth engagement on so many different issues. So, while what you're doing is maybe new for Kentucky, there's a long history of young people getting involved. And I want to talk a little bit more about the kind of advocacy that KSVT does. Beyond the lawsuit, you have a whole movement that you call the Rose Revival Movement, and you're having hearings all across the state on different issues, inviting teachers to testify and experts. Louisa, tell us a little bit more about this Rose Revival Movement and what you've learned from those forums.
We did public forums all across the state, and just getting to interact with community members was definitely really impactful for me. I got to hear so many diverse perspectives and just see truly how education looks different in different regions of Kentucky, how rural communities think of as it in terms of like their education, and also urban areas. Just education is one of the biggest employers in our state. And so communities had a lot to say. There was a lot of passion and a lot of energy. And so seeing that was extremely inspirational for me. And then in terms of the movement, I think for a movement to be alive, you have to keep it active. And so we have been doing a lot of work, even with, we did public forums, and then we launched our lawsuit, and then we published our State of Civics report in March. And then in May, we had our court hearing. And then now we're hosting public hearings across the state. And so we are continuing our work. And we can also see that as we have progressed, a lot more people are becoming aware of what Rose is. And they have been coming to our events. And so there is a lot of energy and excitement and a lot of interest in what we're doing. And so seeing that makes me very hopeful for the future.
Rachel, what is the one thing that you wish listeners would take away from this conversation?
I hope listeners understand that young people like Louisa are not just the future. They're very much a part of the present. They are actively working on real world problems, and they have the capacity to do that. We just need to unleash their power and circulate power and resources around them because we need them. We can't afford to wait till they're older adults. They're valuable right now, even and maybe as, especially as young people.
And what do you expect the movement to look like in 1 year, in 5 years, in 10 years?
Oh, boy, that's a loaded question. Well, you know better than I do with your background how long these things can take to move through the courts. But as Louisa alluded to, we are not waiting. We actually, the Rose revival work that we're doing, the public engagement work, the hearings and the forums, and we're going to be having a book coming out about this case. We're doing additional research that's related to it. All of that is designed to put forth an affirmative vision. It's a complement to a legal complaint. It's an affirmative vision of asking, or young people themselves, as primary stakeholders of our schools, are asking the public to consider, what is it that makes for an adequate public education? What do we want to see in our schools? And I hope, and I'm putting it out into the universe because more than hope, I want to see it happen. I hope that Kentucky as a whole really continues to gain momentum around this vision. And we remind ourselves just how powerful public education is and can be.
Rachel Bellin is the managing partner and co-founder of the Kentucky Student Voice Team, which you can learn more about at ksvt.org. Louisa Sanchez is an impressive student who is helping to lead the litigation efforts. Rachel and Louisa, thank you for joining Democracy Optimist.
Thanks so much for having us.
Thank you so much for the invitation, Josh.
Josh, I think Louisa Sanchez, a senior at Boyle County High, reminds us that teens can be very engaged and knowledgeable about important civic matters going on in their world. What did you hear from Louisa that left you with food for thought?
Wow, how impressive, right? How engaging, how smart, how well-spoken about the issues. I think if we didn't tell you that she was still in high school, you wouldn't know that because of how immersed she is in the issues. And what a great advocate for young people. So I was just really impressed. I loved hearing her optimism. I loved hearing the ways in which she really wants to engage in these efforts, even in the face of, you know, when she talked about some of the opposition that she hears, she's maintaining an optimistic view about what is possible. And of course, as you know, we call the show Democracy Optimist. I love seeing that hope for the future.
Yeah, they kind of embody that optimism, don't they?
Yeah.
Well, you know, Rachel Bellin has been a tireless advocate for giving young people, high school age, more of a say in policies that have impact on their lives and futures. And she raised the hope that Kentucky leaders get it, that our young people need to be engaged. Your thoughts?
Absolutely. I mean, again, I love how it's such a youth-focused conversation. And young people are really wanting to get involved. So, you know, full disclosure, my own daughter decided to become involved in KSVT because she heard about these various efforts and she herself wanted to kind of become involved. And I think it's because people like Louisa and Rachel giving young people a voice to advocate for themselves in a way that we really haven't seen in many other areas of our lives. And so this, to me, is a model of youth engagement. And I think it's really important how Rachel connected that to democracy as well. We're not just talking about the quality of education. We're really talking about the quality of our overall democracy and who can participate in that.
From time to time, we presented 10-minute radio plays here on Eastern Standard. It's been with the aim of stirring creative juices among our playwrights and actors in this listening area. And now we want to bump up that mission just a notch with a new theme and a new purpose. With me here in the studio is Eastern Standard Theater Series contributor Bill McCann. Thanks for joining us, Bill.
Thank you, Tom. Glad to be here.
So we have this new series going on, and you're here to tell us all about it.
Right. So in the past, people could contribute any sort of play that they would like, running about 10 minutes, and it was just wide open. But now we're kind of in an environment in this country where people are having trouble talking to one another. They don't seem to understand what civics is or how to be active in civics in their local community, what all is involved with their physical court, their local government, whatever it is. There seems to be a lack of understanding. And so we're hoping that people will contribute short 10-minute plays. It might be 9 minutes, might be 10, 11, but not any longer than that, discussing these types of things in an informal, fictional format. It could be a drama, could be satire, could be comedy, anything. Discussing democracy and civic engagement, either in their community or fictionally.
So what we want to do is portray or dramatize civics, democracy in action on the local level.
Yes, absolutely.
Who can submit a play?
Anybody. We're obviously hoping that playwrights will do it. That's our general market, I think. They're already familiar with how to do these things. But there are opportunities to learn how to write this kind of play as well. And so anybody who wants to learn how to write a play, a radio drama, can submit it. Or we're hoping that there are a lot of actors, directors, playwrights who want to take on this particular challenge.
And we need to make it clear that not everything that's submitted is going to be used. There's going to be a selection process.
Yes. Now, it won't be. This is not a contest. It'll run for as long as it runs. And as long as people keep submitting, we'll consider them. But yes, they will submit them to us. And then with Civic Lex, we'll select plays to be produced in the studio here. And then they'll be broadcast.
Sound effects, of course, are covered by our sound design and technical director, Neil Kesterson, over there on the other side of the glass. And we're looking forward to making this happen.
Very much so.
Thanks, Bill.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us. Eastern Standard is produced by WEKU and Dynamics Productions. Mike Savage, executive producer. Neil Kesterson, sound designer and technical director. Ella Fitzgeraldine, studio dog. We're on WEKU, Apple, Spotify, and NPR apps, and you can stream all of the interviews from this week's edition online at esweku.org. And while there, you can check out our contributors and their interview archives. Send thoughts and suggestions to es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard.